Nicole Monas ran a textile business in China for 18 years before starting to write about China around 1995. Now she has three critically acclaimed novels published in 19 different languages to her credit. Religions of all kinds are blossoming in China as personal liberties have grown following the opening of China in 1977. These include all mainstream Christian denominations, psychoanalysts, as well as many strange mythological groups. We are honored to welcome Nicole Monas to speak on today's Spiritual Hunger in China.
Forgive me for using notes. I'm a novelist. Never expect a novelist to talk less than 3 hours unless they're constrained somehow. So I'm going to try to stick to my time limit. And I thank you for having me here today. I am not an expert on divinity and faith in China at all. I'm just somebody that's been hanging around China for the past 34 years, and I've explored different aspects of their civilization in my books. The first one, archaeology. The second one, imperial porcelain from the Ming Dynasty. The third one, haute Chinese cuisine, serious high art Chinese food. And now I'm finishing a book about jazz in China in the jazz age of the 1930s and how there was a collision between jazz and the Second World War. None of this is about religion, but you can't help noticing if you're around China over this long period, the period of such great historical change that I've seen, that it's something really interesting is going on there. And if I understand Unitarianism correctly, that it focuses on the oneness of all belief, then this would be of interest to you, what is going on there. Think of it as a lab experiment. Think of it as a country where the structure of belief in divinity, in the beyond, in anything beyond the quotidian rational world, was completely taken away from the population by law and then given back several times in different forms. Not just communism took it away. Did you know that China was feudal until 1911? Until 1911. And Confucianism, which was just briefly explained, was the total structure of the feudal world before 1911. It was really more of a rational belief system and philosophy than a religion. But also it was a government system that's very important. When he mentioned the respect for authority, that translates in Confucianism to absolute vertical submission. Father, mayor, governor, all the way up to the emperor. Absolute submission. So if you've known away for thousands of years, China was a theocracy without the theo part. And when all that changed, other religions were there, but the state was kind of set up to occupy a place like religion in people's belief system because of Confucianism. So in addition to Confucianism, as you heard, Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity, also Islam are very big in China and have been for a long time. But those are just what we call religions. There are many areas of faith that are kind of gray and not really religious, but are hugely important there. Ancestor worship, you're probably aware of. Folk religion. Folk religion is very local. And that means that in local places, people worship their local deities. They worship folk heroes, demigods, supernatural beings of various kinds. One of the interesting things about it, it's completely unorganized and local and personal, but one interesting thing about it is that a lot of the people that are worshipped in folk religion, I mean the deities, were people. They were heroes of some bygone time. They actually lived and they did things that people now admire so much that they've kind of deified them. Two interesting points to remember about this are that real people become gods and that Confucianism, as was explained a little earlier, literally legitimized the government through the mandate of heaven. You probably wondered why China's so paranoid about religion right now. I'm sure you've heard a lot of things about lack of freedom of religion there, but this is why. Because under the mandate of heaven, if a belief system arises that gets enough people's attention and is powerful enough to possibly introduce the idea that there's time for a change of dynasty, right? Think of us in a time of threatened dynasty, even though we're in the modern world. This is very threatening to them. This is probably a good time for me to stop and tell you exactly what is banned in China religiously, because I think there's a great deal of misunderstanding about that. There are two things that are banned in China. You can be in any religion you want. You can worship publicly any way you want, as long as you don't do one of these two things. Number one, you cannot be a Tibetan Buddhist who worships the practices the form of the religion that answers to the Dalai Lama. Because guess what? China cruelly annexed Tibet, and they regard the Dalai Lama and all his followers as people that might want to overthrow their dynasty because they want Tibet back. The other thing you can't do, well, then they have another, I'm sorry, I should explain that. In Lamaistic Buddhism, that is the Tibetan form, the Panchen Lama is kind of a puppet Dalai Lama that the Chinese have put there. So you can be a Lamaistic Buddhist in China, but you can't legally worship in the temple that answers to the Dalai Lama. You have to go to the one that answers to the Panchen Lama, who's kind of a fake. So the other thing is in Catholicism. The Vatican happens to be the only country left in the world, if you consider them a country, that refuses to recognize China as a country. And so China has returned the compliment by saying, well then, any bishops that answer to the Pope cannot be in China. So they have set up their own alternate bishopric. Is that the right word? So they have Catholic bishops in China, but they don't answer to the Pope because the Pope is, and the Vatican are totally non grata in China. Outside those two things, you can do anything you want, pretty much. And now that everything's open, it's exploding. So you can imagine how big a thing it was when Confucianism took away a whole way of life in 1911. Not just your philosophy, but at that time, everything you did was controlled by what your parents told you to do, what was the right thing to do for your family, your community, and there was very little personal freedom ingrained in that system. So everything was upended. And then the communists took over in 1949. I am not going to dwell on this. Let me just say China was in tatters. Okay, the situation was very, very bad in 1949. Believe it or not, when religion was outlawed at that time, it was rather quickly replaced by this kind of optimism in, wow, the government is going to rebuild our totally broken country. And it may sound strange now, but there was the first kind of new religion in China, which only existed really from 1949 to about 1956, was this brief, short-lived faith in this new communist ideal. It didn't last long as a substitute religion because by the late 1950s, there were extremist movements that put all kinds of people in prison. Then the government decided on this cockamamie scheme to modernize China overnight through the Great Leap Forward, which led to a famine, which caused 31 million deaths from starvation. So in 1961, one in 27 Chinese who were alive in 1961 died of starvation. The other 26 suffered terribly. Almost everybody you meet who was alive then lost a family member or a close friend to starvation. So if you had any faith in the government after that, it was completely gone. And then came the Cultural Revolution, which you've probably heard about, which killed 6 to 10 million people. So by the time I first arrived in China in 1977, all religious faith or belief that had been vested in the government was completely gone. Well, that sounds really bad, doesn't it? But here's where it gets kind of interesting, because in China, all these events are not viewed quite the same way as we view them here. Like we view the Cultural Revolution as a completely evil Holocaust type of event. Strangely enough, in China now, I'm talking about, and people had no nostalgia for it in the first 5 or 10 years after. But once 15 or 20 years had gone by, people remembered having a faith that they had not, that they don't have anymore. I know this is counterintuitive and it's a little hard to accept. Why would people be so nostalgic? Why would they think that the Cultural Revolution had these higher aspects? I remember my mind being blown when somebody said to me, well, at least back then, there was some wrenching human kindness. Really? Human kindness in a conflagration that killed 6 to 10 million people? So it was a rampage. It was chaos. And I wanted to find out more why people believed that. I won't tell you all the research I did and all the people I interviewed and stuff, but I came to realize that the Cultural Revolution itself was a religious movement in China. So was the Great Leap Forward that led to the famine. So were those extremist movements in the late 50s. By the Cultural Revolution, a powerful cult of personality was in place around Mao. And there was a very Puritan traditional morality driving it. You know, for people at that time, there were very pure ideals that they were pursuing. They had a vision of communes as a traditional utopian way of life. There was to be no privacy, no selfishness, no individualism. When I first arrived in China, the Cultural Revolution had ended 6 weeks before. Everyone was in an obvious state of mass post-traumatic stress disorder. There was, any optimism that was gone. But years later, nostalgia for that time started to emerge. One clue as to why that happened is what happened in between. Remember when Deng Xiaoping said, to get rich is glorious. Let's forget all that socialist stuff. Everybody go out and make money. Well, that was the God. That was faith in China for, about 10 years. Everybody dropped everything else and focused on the glory of getting not just money, but, they used to call it the 48 legs. You have four legs on your fridge, you got four legs on your couch, you have four legs on your bed. You know, getting the basic 48 legs of furniture in your apartment. Just try to imagine what it's like for people who have never had central heating and have never had an indoor toilet, have used an outhouse in the street. I mean, these are huge things. You can forgive them for adopting this 100% as a gigantic religion. But, of course, people always find out that money isn't worth very much once they get it. And so that's what happened. And then all this nostalgia for this previous time when people had a sense of faith, even though things went so bad, started to appear. And by that time, I was writing articles for Gourmet magazine as a freelancer, kind of in between writing novels. And I noticed in Beijing this really strange thing happening. These restaurants were opening up that were like historical revival restaurants. Now, you've seen pioneer restaurants here, right? Okay, the waitresses might wear some calico. You might have some theme decor. But you're not going to be going in those restaurants and eating hardtack and beans and what they were actually eating on the trail west, right? In China, these restaurants were like so correct, you couldn't believe it. The food of the early 1920s Beijing. Then there was the restaurant that focused on the 18th century style of imperial food in the Forbidden City. One of the weirdest ones was the Neolithic restaurant, Cave Art Decor. I was expecting to see Wilma and Betty and Fred, you know, on the walls. That was the only restaurant I went in where they didn't serve the food of the era. But they serve modern food, but that's the only one. The strangest one of all was the Cultural Revolution Revival restaurant. Why were people driving up in cars, stepping out of their cars in pressed, dry-cleaned clothes, walking in with expensive cell phones and plunking down good money to eat fried insects, and tree leaves, and corn pone, and the kinds of things that they had to subsist on for much of that 10-year period? So when I saw this and I really couldn't understand it, I emailed the woman who was editing Gourmet, Ruth Reichel, and I said, something really strange is going on in Beijing. All these people are crowding into these restaurants and debasing themselves, you know, to relive something that I thought was kind of horrible. Can I write an article about that? She goes, no food magazine in America has ever published anything like that. But it sounds good. Go ahead. So I rush in and start interviewing these people, and to my amazement, they were there for real reasons of faith. And I will just quote one gentleman of the many interviews I gave. He summed it up great. He said he had been himself sent to far northern China where it is colder than you can imagine. Imagine being sent to the Yukon, and he claimed he lived for 2 years in a straw hut, and the worst part about it was no oil and no salt. Try to imagine that. You're living in a straw hut, no heat, but the worst thing is your food is completely lacking in oil and salt. I said, well, why are you here reliving that? And he said, maybe it was misguided. Maybe we were wrong. But back then we were living for something. Now it's all money. So I come to places like this looking for satisfaction in the past that I can't find in the present. So this was my first opening to realizing, well, something really strange is going on here. People need to believe in their own, whether it's faith in a political system, whether it's religious faith. People are lost without something to believe in. And then when I looked around, I saw this played out in so many other ways. You might have heard that all Christian sects are doing bang up business in missionary work in China, doing fantastically, raising the numbers of people that they convert and that join churches. The role of the church in immigrant life, I just have to point out, is playing part of that. If you're a new immigrant to a country like America, your church is really important to you. All the things that you get here in your fellowship, think of them as three times more critical to people who are newly arrived Americans and might not speak the language. But despite that, the way that Chinese people, whether they're here or in China, are mobbed by religious people who are proselytizing is amazing. Listen to this blog post from a Chinese graduate student who has come to study in America. Ever since I came to the States, I have been fighting off all forms of invitation of conversion from all denominations, Methodists, Baptists, Catholics, Catholicism, Presbyterianism, Mennonite, even Jewish. A lot of Protestant Christian groups on campus deliberately target fresh-off-the-boat Chinese students. I am fed up with this unsolicited, contagious religiosity. So the hunger that Chinese people have to re-enter the world of faith is something definitely recognized by missionaries. But folk religion is exploding too. Now guess who's become a folk god? Mao Zedong. I know. You see this altar over here? You go into a Hunan restaurant in China now, and Hunan was Mao's home province. They have an altar like this in the back of the restaurant. Big portrait of Mao, like a bust, maybe a sculpture of Mao also. His favorite foods would be there. His favorite fire, water, alcohol, a few glasses of that would be there. Another thing that you see a lot is you get in a taxi, especially in Beijing, where people are very historically minded, and there's these little pictures of Mao hanging from the rearview mirror. I said, what's up with the Mao? You know, I would expect a little irony in the response, right? I never hear a shred of irony. They would say, oh, he's going to protect me from getting into an accident. He's watching over me. And I bite my tongue then to not say, what are you talking about? He was insane. But the thing is, because Mao is seen by us as completely evil, like Hitler and Pol Pot. And he was, I think probably he was a man who was an effective, charismatic leader early in his life, and he may have become mentally ill and unbalanced and whatever. He obviously was very evil and thoughtless in the last part of his life and responsible for many millions of deaths. But that's not the point. The point is what people believe. The point is what people see and what they need to see. To a lot of people, he's still the founder of modern China, still a symbol of justice and equality. Forget whether it's true or not. It shows you the hunger for something to believe in. Another clue to this amazing hunger is the return of Dr. Freud. Remember psychoanalysis? Long in decline in America. I think the death knell of psychoanalysis here might have been when Bruno Bettelheim said of all those Vietnam War protesters, they're acting out their edible fantasies. Well, history kind of put that in a different perspective, and psychoanalysis has totally declined here. Well, in China, there was suddenly such a great demand for psychoanalysis that there are analysts in America that have long been out of work and struggling to just, you know, put a roof over their heads, are now doing analysis by Skype for Chinese patients. And the last few psychoanalysts who are left standing in America are suddenly also being hired to rush over there and train psychoanalysts. It's partly the boom in psychoanalysis. I have to say it's partly related to mental health, the whole idea that you could do something about your mental health being sort of a new idea there. But I don't really view psychoanalysis the same way as everything else that's therapeutic. Don't you think psychoanalysis is kind of a faith system? It's just a little more of a belief system. And to me, that's rising. That Freudian psychoanalysis is rising, not just counseling, you know, family therapy and stuff like that. That's really interesting. And then there's some really fun stuff. Guess what everybody in China believes in? Bigfoot. You thought Bigfoot was just in the Western U.S. and Canada? No. Bigfoot is in those foothills of the Himalayas, out in Sichuan and Qinghai. Oh, a lot of people have seen his footprints, and they'll tell you about it, and you'll hear about it on the radio a lot. And they have a lot of UFOs, too. It's very hard to take a taxi ride in China without listening to a talk show on whether people are raging in arguments about whether there really are UFOs. So here's an interesting thing about that. My first novel, it was about archaeology in China, and I myself worked as an interpreter on an archaeological expedition in 1991. I've stayed friends with those archaeologists. They go back to China every year, and they've done a whole lot of work in the far north of China. They have told me about this place. So there's a place that way, way out in far northwest China, which is really Central Asia, called Mount Baigong. And my archaeologist friends who have driven past it multiple times because they have excavated in this area, and this is an area that's very militarily sensitive, a lot of missile ranges out there, a lot of secret Chinese, you know, military installations. Well, you're not allowed to get out of your car and explore Mount Baigong on foot because it is adjacent to one of these nuclear things or whatever, but you can drive near it and, you know, you can look at it. So these people who are absolutely trained high-level archaeologists are able to look at this when they drive past it and see exactly what it is. It's a depression in the desert, and there's a hill rising in the middle of it, which is called Mount Baigong, but the archaeologists can see it was a lake at one time in ancient times, you know, and that was an island in the lake. here's what's led to the mystery. Ancient people put irrigation pipes in this hill that rose in the middle of the lake. To the archaeologists, it's as clear as day what they are, because they've seen this in many, you know, prehistoric things that they've studied. But you can't get that past the Chinese population. They are absolutely sure that aliens came from outer space. Why else would there be pipes in the middle of a hill, sitting in the middle of an unoccupied desert out in Central Asia? Why Mount Baigong is now China's Area 51. There are websites devoted to it, and people argue about it, and people dream of going out there, but they can't get too close to it, and they think, just like Area 51, they think the reason they can't get into it is because it proves that there are UFOs and aliens, when actually the reason is because it's in a military area. But those are fun, and it's an amazing example of the fact that people need to fill this gap in some way. But on a more serious note, at the beginning of the service, Taoism was beautifully described, and one of the things that I've seen in China that has made me optimistic, it is rare, but I find it very poignant and moving, that I have met multiple young people who are under 30 who have turned their little apartments into Taoist meditation areas with altars to their Taoist masters and spiritual works in archaic Chinese displayed, you know, on their shelves. And people are young. There are young people in China who are starting to, like, try to return to traditional ways of thinking. Oh, I'm going to become a vegetarian. I'm going to follow Taoist texts and see if I can integrate that into the modern world. You don't think of China as being a democratic place. But right now, when it comes to faith and spirituality, everyone is looking in their own way, and it is completely democratic in the way that, as long as you don't worship the Dalai Lama or the Pope, you can go to Bigfoot, you can go to UFOs, you can go to anything you want, and it's really fascinating to me to watch what they're going to do next. I think it's time for the offertory now, but I will come back and answer questions. Thank you. That's a good question, and I'm glad you asked it, because when 9/11 happened, the Chinese government was like, right, oh yeah, we'll have you put down those extremists, we've got some of them. Well, there was no religious fundamentalism in China's northwest, but there has long been a nationalist fundamentalism in China's northwest. There are millions of Muslims in China's northwest who dream of breaking apart from China and restoring a country that they once called Tartary. Remember that word, Tartary? Not since the 30s has it been called. Have they been Tartars? But that's the dream of the Muslims out there as of September 11th, 2001. Now, naturally, since then, I would have no doubt that Al Qaeda operatives would have moved into there from neighboring countries like Kazakhstan and Pakistan. But the Chinese government absolutely used 9/11 as a PR thing. You know, well, that's probably the wrong. Yes, to make it seem like they were cooperating with the anti-terrorist thing. And the real problem they had out there is that every so often these people who want to go back to being Tartars and get out from under the yoke of the Chinese government that basically annexed them, from some time to time they blow up buses. You know, and they plant bombs in the marketplace. It's a small, low-level terrorism. But it wasn't fundamentalist. But the Chinese are riding the coattails of the 9/11 thing so that they can crack down on them a little more without us getting mad. We don't give them that leeway with Tibet. But it's terrible that we look the other way when they crack down on the Muslims in the northwest, because it isn't Al-Qaeda. The Falun Gong is a, if you don't know, I'm sure you probably do know, it's a cult headed by a guy who fled China shortly after he founded it. It's co-opts a lot of helpful elements of Qigong and stuff. It's philosophically borrows from Chinese traditions, but it also has very mystical elements. The leader claims that he can levitate, and that people who follow the cult, if they are, you know, if they're true and they work hard, they too will learn to levitate. And this is not representing Tibet, and it's not representing Xinjiang. It represents something else, though, that's very, very frightening to the Chinese government and causes them to react in this paranoid way. Falun Gong demonstrated from the get-go their ability to organize people on the Internet. From the beginning, the first time Falun Gong emerged in the public view, I think it was in the 90s, they sent out an Internet call. 10,000 people show up in Tiananmen Square tomorrow. They didn't want them to do anything. They just wanted them to do it, to show up, and they did. Of course, the Chinese government went ballistic with paranoia. What you probably don't know is that leading to the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1911, there were three or four fundamentalist religious movements that arose, all from religion, and almost toppled the emperor. One of them that's quite famous that I'm sure you've heard of is the Taiping Rebellion. The Taiping Rebellion was started by a man who said, "You know Jesus? Well, I'm the younger brother. I'm God's second son. You guys follow me, we're marching on Peking, and God is protecting us. They're going to shoot you, but bullets will bounce off you." And so this is how the Taiping Rebellion got started. It wasn't that different from Falun Gong. So the paranoia, what seems to you like, why aren't they letting these people worship? They don't care about their worship. What they care about is that they're kind of flaunting a few times. They're a bit, look what we can do. We can call out people. So that's why they banned them. So the question is, since about 90% of people in China are Han, and they have moved, Han population has moved into areas and have other minority populations moved in and diluted the Han, is your question? Yes, and that's historically the case. What's changed in the last decades is that China has annexed some border states, like Tibet and Xinjiang, that were completely occupied by minority populations, and moved large amounts of Han Chinese in, and that, like we were saying a minute ago, had a huge economic effect on the minority people. There are other areas in China where there are some more, I think there's 58 minority groups in China. So there are other areas in China that are still rather more minority than Han. But I think globalization and homogenization, which is inevitable in a world where people are traveling more, and also where information is just being is completely, you know, centralized and everybody's it's everywhere. It's going to be these things are going to homogenize gradually, and I do think we're going to see the disappearance of the smaller minority languages. There are still some 4 dozen at least that are spoken, but that's going to decline. Ooh, that's an interesting question. Is there a concept of manifest destiny? The concept of the mandate of heaven that we were talking about is extremely important, but people in China have a greater belief in fate. I think they understand fate a little differently than we do. Like if you meet someone by chance and you end up having a good conversation, they will remind you it was our fate to meet here today. We were meant to come here today and talk. If I meet you in the coffee and carb room after, and you say you like my talk, if we were in China, I would say it was my fate to be here and share this with you. Another thing that I find kind of comforting, people still, the folk religion still clings to concepts of reincarnation. And when people say goodbye to you, you know, when there are times you say goodbye to people, you know you're never going to see them again. When you say goodbye to someone for the last time, and they will say, still, they might say, "It's been great knowing you. See you next life. Sha yi bei zhe, next life." And there's a sense there of fate drawing people, and there's a sense of continuing, that your life will continue into successive lifetimes, and that your purpose in those successive lifetimes is also somewhat driven by destiny. So manifest destiny, maybe not quite, but there is a sense of something more than just your personal choices, which I think is another way of filling the vacuum. Okay, thank you.